This is Entrepreneur Radio. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
Well, Entrepreneur Radio, we are dedicated to inspiring you, the leaders of today and tomorrow, and to help tell real stories of the trials and tribulations and triumphs of entrepreneurs. And you know what? These people have gone out and lived the life. They've achieved their dreams and their goals. And so we're glad to have guests on to help you guys that are on that that journey to shine a lamp onto your feet to know that you're either on the right road or you're not. Maybe this show will help that. Our guest today is Michael Kempner. He is the founder and CEO of MWWPR. He is nationally recognized authority on reputation management, crisis management, public affairs, business-to-business, consumer marketing, and corporate social responsibility. And the list goes on and on. He's also considered one of the world's most prominent executives. He's also been given PR Week's PR Professional of the Year. I'm happy to have you on the show, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Alan. It's great to be here.
So, you know, I love whenever I see something like this, you know, reputation management, crisis management. Oh, my God, that's an entrepreneur right there every day. You know, we live in crisis, Michael.
You know, I actually once read an article early in my career that the single greatest factor that motivates entrepreneurs is fear.
Yeah.
You wake up every morning and you're afraid that you're going to be found out, that you're a fraud, and that's why you keep pushing forward.
Wow. You know what? I can tell you that there's so much of life that our brains try to trick us constantly, because I feel like, you know, that when you do something and you get really good at it, you think to yourself, God, anybody could do this. Why are they paying me to do this? Anybody could do this. And then you start to doubt. Doubt creeps in. Then you start to feel like you said, you know, like, God, you know, am I a fraud? And so I have a feeling that doubt plays a big part in that. Now, I'm sure there are people that are frauds. They worry about that. But the reality is, you know, people say to me all the time, well, you're so good at what you do. And I think, what? I just talk to people. But I think being authentic, there's no special talent in being authentic. I'm just authentically me. But other people have been taught something in their lives, and they think they have to be a certain way, act a certain way. And maybe they are a fraud because they're not being themselves in that moment. So I think doubt is a really big thing that entrepreneurs really have to get over. They have to get courage. They have to believe in themselves. But I think reputation management, crisis management, all these things do come into play at some point. You own a business, somebody, you know, eats something, they get sick, and oh my gosh, you know, look at Chipotle, for example. I love Chipotle. I have friends who are like, I never go to Chipotle because six people got sick. Yeah, but they have 1,000 locations. That doesn't mean they're all going to get sick, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, man, this is a big job. Public relations is a big job, whether you're a big company or a little company.
So much today is based on people's perception of you.
Right, yeah.
Your consumer makes a decision based on so many factors. What people forget at the end of the day, the consumers really make their decision based on emotional connective tissue, not even the feature sets. So it's how you represent yourself internally, externally, how you treat your employees, how you treat your customers, what does your business stand for, what is the product you deliver. It's a very significant web of different attributes that at the end of the day determine whether or not people are going to come work for you, buy your service or product, continue to support you, etc.
Very interesting. So you have this company, MWWPR. You sold it, and then you bought it back later on. A lot of people do that these days. I have a friend that he sold his company millions and millions of dollars. 5 or 6 years later, he says to me, I'm buying my company. I'm miserable. It's not going the way I want. I got to buy it. $55 million he had to come up with. He bought it back. And I thought to myself, who does that? Why? But I think more people do that than we're really conscious of. That's your baby. You know, you gave birth to that company. Maybe you could talk just for a moment about MWWPR.
Well, I think the goal of most entrepreneurs or many entrepreneurs first is to create something big, special, legacy building. But it's also at some point to create wealth, to create value, to create something lasting for you and your family. And so when you begin, you don't really think that someone one day is going to come in and offer me a lot of money for your business. But at some point, you've built a real enterprise. And then you decide what is the right next step. Some people sell because they don't have the management depth. Or we buy a lot of companies because people love practicing the art, but they don't like the business side, collecting your bills,
right.
Management. Employee issues, management. So people sell for all sorts of reasons. In our case, the business was doing quite well. This is 2000, and if you recall, if you go back to 2000, this was the you were deep into the dot-com boom, the first
right.
one.
Right.
And valuations were through the roof. Business was coming in over the transom, and it was a great time to be in the public relations business. At the same time, the world was in a growth mania. Every industry was trying to buy more revenue in their sectors so they could become bigger, which then allowed them to raise more money, which then allowed them to become bigger.
Hang on one second. Let me take a quick break. I want to hear this story. I sold a business and bought it back one time. I want to hear the rest of the story, because if you're thinking about selling your business, we've got the expert right now, Michael Kempner, founder and CEO of MWWPR.com on the web. This is Entrepreneur Radio. We'll be right back.
There's an old man.
Stay tuned. There's more Entrepreneur Radio after these messages.
Well, you're listening to Entrepreneur Radio. Thanks for joining us. Don't forget, check out our website, entrepreneur.com. The October issue of the magazine on newsstands everywhere right now. Bobby Flay on the cover. Build an empire, it says. Love it. A lot of the food industry masters in this issue of the magazine. Our guest right now, Michael Kempner. We're talking about PR, reputation management, crisis management, selling your company, and then buying it back again, which I did one time. My quick story is I sold it. It was gone for, I don't know, probably 5 years. The guy lost interest in it, and I saw him, and I go, what are you doing? He says, why don't you just buy it back? And I did. And it was like, man, like 10 cents on the dollar. So I had to buy it back. And I was very happy, too. I mean, I was actually ready to go again. You know what I mean? So, but you sold your company, MWWPR. And then we were kind of getting to that, you know, the middle of the story there. What happened after you decided to buy it back?
Well, so, I mean, so we sold it because it was a unique time in the economy. And I thought at that point, being part of a global holding company would benefit my team, my clients, and allow us to grow rapidly.
Right.
A month after we sold it, the economy crashed.
Oh.
So our business remained strong, being smaller, nimble, still having that independent feel and spirit kept us, we were going strong. We were perfectly positioned for an unstable economy. Mm. But the parent company who had bought us became focused on many other things and
right.
didn't really have time for integration, nor did they really spend much time worrying about us. That had benefits and attractions. They gave us little support to grow, but at the same time, they left us alone to do what we do best and didn't do much to change our culture or to change the way we operated. So a down economy is actually a very strong time for those who are confident, can create true value, and can be nimble and react to the changes. Mm. So we continued to do well for 10 years, and I remained there the entire time as the CEO.
Wow.
But after about 8 years or so, I'm really an entrepreneur at heart, and I began to think that this is really what I want to do. Do I want to be owned by someone else and part of, I don't want to say dictates because it wasn't a negative experience, but part of how they view the world.
Right.
And that really wasn't for me.
Yeah.
So it was really either time to leave and go start something new, leave it in good hands and make sure that they received great value for the money they paid, or buy back. So it took a year or two, but we spoke, and originally they had no interest in selling it back. But after a year or so of conversation, I was able to buy back along with my management team.
Gosh.
And, you know, I really didn't know how much of a weight the ownership was on our shoulders until the day I sold it. And you could see a change, almost a glow, and it sounds coming from the employees. They were emoting from within. All of a sudden, this huge weight was lifted off of people, and our entrepreneurial spirit came roaring back.
That's awesome. Well, you know what? I see here that you're a very active businessman, one of the founding board members of Connect One Bank, and a board member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Nobody told me that! I got to take a break, and I got to get a cup of coffee. Whew. When we come back, you're going to help us a little information and advice on a company or an entrepreneur looking to sell their business. We're talking with Michael Kempner, founder and CEO of MWWPR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Entrepreneur Radio. Here's Alan Taylor.
Our guest, Michael Kempner, is a founder and CEO of MWWPR, and he now is going to give us some advice for business owners that are considering selling their companies. He's been through it. I've been through it. If you do it right, I believe that it's a great thing. But if you don't do it right, then I imagine it can be a lot of headaches. Michael, how about some advice on selling a company?
Well, I think the two most important lessons I learned, or things I did. First, I met with anybody and everybody. I probably met with 10 to 15 different organizations, holding companies, private equity firms, individuals that were interested in buying us. And what that did was it made me a very informed seller. Mm. I even received term sheets and got into negotiations. And so by the time I was really ready to sell, I didn't really need my lawyers except for the legal documents. I had a very good understanding of what I was worth, what the different formulas were, how you can get paid, what kind of operating agreement you can insist upon. So number one is do whatever you can to be a very informed seller.
Yep.
Learn about what makes you attractive, what your value is, and what are the reasonable and then the not reasonable things to ask for. Because at the end of the day, you want a good, productive negotiation. You're going to be living with these people.
Yeah.
So understand what's fair. Understand what's not fair. Don't get taken advantage of, but don't take advantage of them either. But so I had a very good negotiation because I truly understood, after spending a year or two of meeting and almost interviewing prospective buyers, that allowed me to become an educated seller. The other most important thing is continue to run your business as if you're not going to sell it. Things happen. The morning of a sale, the stock market could crash. They could decide not to buy you. You could decide not to sell. But if you've been working on your business to sell it, that means many of the things and decisions you would have normally made, you probably put off or didn't do. And it continues to make you more valuable. They don't want to see your value go down while you're negotiating. So continue to run your business as if you're not going to sell it. You almost have to separate your brain into two halves.
Right.
The person negotiating the sale and the person running the business, and you really need to keep them separate.
You know, it's interesting. I'll stop you right there because I think this could be one of the biggest problems people have when they start thinking about selling their business. They don't stay the course. They don't stay to what the core of what they do. They already start on to the next thing. Now, I'm guilty of this too, believe me. Same with cars. I mean, I happen to love cars, but as soon as I'm on to the next car, my last car starts to languish. It's like, I don't care. I don't keep the bird poop off it anymore. You know, it starts losing its shine in essence. Well, that happens to your business too. And it's not as desirable to anybody else. You got to keep loving on that business right on through the process. That's what you're saying. I think great advice. Keep rolling.
You got to run through that tape. If not, the values of your business won't be the same as the day you begin to talk to them. And in particularly in a professional service organization, at least 50% of your payment is contingent based on performance.
Yeah.
So if you can't continue to grow your business, and if you've taken your eye off the prize, then the value and your experience in the sale are not going to be particularly fulfilling.
Yeah. The formulas. So you mentioned something in there, and they're very good, by the way. Meet with potential buyers, get informed, get educated. What formulas do the buyers use? What's fair to both parties? Stay the course. I want to go back to formulas. How do you find in advance? I mean, who can you talk to in advance of what formulas people use? So you have a few of these, so you can at least cross a few T's, dot a few I's.
Well, I mean, the simplest way, but the most expensive, is to bring in an investment banker. So investment bankers that are experts in your area or in your vertical will typically know what's reasonable at the time.
Yeah, they've got like a menu they work off of, right? I mean, they know
right. But valuations change all the time. The models change constantly depending on what's going on in the marketplace.
Yeah.
But that's an expensive proposition. You have to pay them hefty fees and success fees. Often lawyers that are expert in the industry can help you because, you know, they know that if they give you the right advice that they will get the deal, or they can charge you to give them advice. So lawyers that are true experts in your industry, not in M&A, but in your industry, are good sources. And then again, what I did was I talked to a lot of people and I asked them, how would you value a company like mine? How do you value companies in general? What do your deals look like? And so between experts I spoke to and just truly, while I was being interviewed by potential buyers, I was actually interviewing them, and I learned a tremendous amount through that process. So it was a combination of several pieces, but the biggest piece was me learning through the process. I didn't choose to use an investment banker the first time around because it was, again, it was too expensive, and because of the supercharged economy, I didn't need to use an investment banker. Given our company today, I might think differently if I sold it again.
Great advice. The website is mww.com. This has been very helpful, Michael. Michael Kempner, founder and CEO of MWWPR, and I really appreciate the advice because I'm keeping my eye open for that opportunity for myself. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Alan. I appreciate it.
All right. There is more Entrepreneur Radio right after these words. Stay with us.
Entrepreneur Radio. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
All right, so what if you were in the middle of a negotiation and things are not going your way? What do you do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You don't get yourself in that position. Do a little bit of research. Our next guest is going to help with that, Chris Voss. He is the CEO, author, negotiation expert. The dude has spent 24 years in the FBI, now retired. He's the author of a national bestseller, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. I mean, you know, that's some serious stuff, right? Chris is on the line with us here. Chris, do me a favor. Give everybody the 1 minute download on Chris Voss, because you have a very interesting background.
I was the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator. I learned that, you know, the secret emotional intelligence skills of hostage negotiation. And I wrote a book, and we're putting it in business negotiation. People are making phenomenal deals. They're doing stuff that they couldn't do before that other people can't do. It's very cool.
You know what? It's like, you know, when you go into a negotiation, and when you find yourself and all of a sudden your face goes flush because you don't know what to say to what the other person just said, and you're like, oh, you know, it's the most frustrating feeling in the world, because you wish you had somebody like Chris Voss sitting next to you who you go, what should I do? What should I say? You know, I mean, you watch like Shark Tank and they're like, can we go outside and talk for a minute? And they go, no, make your decision now. You know, otherwise we're all out. It's like, oh, crap, I didn't think of that. I didn't think they were going to say no. You know what I mean? So you got to be ready. You got to have your ducks in a row. You got to have some, gosh, you got to just have some ammunition is what it boils down to. So let's try to help. I understand you have 9 effective principles that companies and employees can use to become more persuasive in their professional and personal lives. So I read that, of course. Give me some of those 9.
One of them is this incredibly flexible skill we call a label, which is just, it's simplistic and scientific at the same time. Like it's to say, like, it sounds like, it seems like, it looks like. So, for example, somebody says no to you, then an automatic label response is, well, it seems like there's something that would work. Now, that sounds innocent, and it's intended to sound innocent. But what it does was, it seems like is a carefully crafted phrase that gets the other person thinking, and it actually gets them answering the question that you never asked. It's actually a better way to pull information out of somebody than flat out asking them what would work.
Right.
Even the design of what would work, it's an open-ended question. It puts the person on guard that you're looking for information. And the, you know, this whole label design, one of my clients referred to it as unlocking the floodgates of truth-telling. People give you a lot of unguarded information with that approach.
Wow. See, now that's brilliant. It really is the art and science of negotiation at that point.
Yeah. Actually, it started out as an art. I mean, hostage negotiation started in the 1970s. And the cool thing about these days is with electromagnetic brain imaging and brain scans, we actually see the science proving that a statement like that stimulates very specific parts of the brain and causes reactions, which is what we're always doing as hostage negotiators.
Wow. It seems like such an innocent thing. It seems like. Good Lord. Okay. That's beautiful.
You gotta watch out for them innocent statements, too, man. You know, if I start sounding innocent, you're in trouble.
Right. But that's the beauty of it, because you're not doing anything. What you're doing is you're opening a door for a person. And listen, they're bottled up. And if you open the door, it's going to come out. That's what you're saying. The truth will come out.
You know, that's it exactly. People are bottled up with so much they want to say that all you got to do is figure out how to open that door and it'll come out.
You're like a truth whisperer. It seems like, right? I love it. Okay. This is a big one. I'm going to put this on my wall. It seems like everybody's going to walk in and I'm going to go, it seems like you got something to say. I love it. Okay. So we got 1, and if you got 9 of these babies, I'm going to be the best negotiator in the world. Okay. Chris Voss again, everybody, the Black Swan Group. He spent 24 years in the FBI in negotiations with terrorists and what have you. So give me another one. I love that one.
Another one, again, it's insanely simple. It's what we call a mirror. And it's not the mirroring that everybody learns about where you're mirroring body language, or, you know, if they put their right hand to their chin, you put your right hand to your chin. It's not that. The hostage negotiator's mirror is just repeating the last 1 to 3 words of what somebody's just said. Mm. Now, that's particularly good, like when the other side says something in a negotiation that shocks you, and you actually need to buy yourself 3 seconds, which when your brain is moving, 3 seconds is all you need to get yourself back into the game. So repeating the last 3 words of what someone has just said, it also connects something in their head. And again, it unlocks, it opens the door. They start talking because they don't know that you just opened this door, and they're talking. And then the first time I ever did this, I was negotiating a bank robbery in Brooklyn, which is a really unusual event, even though it happens in the movies all the time. And the bank robber was trying to hide his identity from us, and we'd figured out who he was. We located his van. And I'm going to confront him over who he is by telling him we found his van. So I go, you know, we got a van outside. We've identified everybody that owns the van. He's like, yeah. I said, this van belongs to Chris Watts. And he goes, we only have one van. Could you only have one van? He said, yeah, we have more than one van. And I mirrored that. It makes sense to me. I said, we have more than one van? Then he says, but you chased my driver away. And what he did with that statement, that was the unguarded information. There was a getaway driver that had gotten away that we didn't even know was part of the bank run. And if I'd have said to him, who else is there with you guys? He never would have answered that question.
No, he would have said the opposite. Nobody. I got to tell you, let me take a break.
Right.
Hold on. It seems like we got to take a break because the music's playing. So
exactly.
Let me just, right. I love this stuff. Chris Voss, the Black Swan Group. You can find them at blackswanltd.com. Brilliant stuff. Again, his book, national bestseller, is Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It, which it does. We'll be right back. It's Entrepreneur Radio.
You're listening to Entrepreneur Radio. Here's Alan Taylor.
Our guest is Chris Voss, interesting man. Chris is retired as the lead international kidnap negotiator, 24 years in the FBI on the East Coast, New York, Boston, and now in L.A. High-stakes negotiations, you know, and here's the deal. Every negotiation is high stakes in business because otherwise you wouldn't be, you know, having to negotiate. You'd be going, hey, I'll give you this for that. Oh, that's a good deal. You know, back and forth you go and you're done. But when you get into these big negotiations, and some of them take a long, long time, a few little secrets like we learned about, it seems like you can kind of whisper the truth out of there. You know, it's a kind of a truth whispering method to get people to say things. I love it too, by the way. Out of the last segment, I got buy yourself 3 seconds. When somebody says something that you get taken aback by yourself 3 seconds by repeating the last few words they said as if you're pondering it. Am I right, Chris?
Yeah, it sounds like you're pondering it to them. And then also, since you repeated, and you got to repeat the exact, pretty much exact words, like don't paraphrase. Because what that also tells them is you heard the words they used, so they won't come back at you with the exact same words.
Right.
They'll expand and go on. As opposed to, like, if you'd have said, you know, I need 9 Shadrachs, and I'd have said, what's a Shadrach? And you'd be like an American overseas. You'd be like, a Shadrach. Everybody knows what a Shadrach is. But if I just said Shadrachs, you'd be like, yeah, you know, they're these special transistor radio things. They're tiny little batteries. You describe them. So that's the other neat trick about mirroring.
That's called mirroring. Okay. How do you identify someone's trigger patterns and what happens once you see that? It seems like maybe you it helps to diminish negativity or negative feelings. How do you identify that?
Well, it's principally going to come by from a change in their tonality. Like, you know, the 90 seconds of solid gold, a friend of mine, Ned Colletti, used to be the general manager for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He took him from worst to first, and he's a great negotiator. He's a great listener. The reason why he listens, Ned said, in every two-hour conversation, he says his 90 seconds of solid gold is going to tell me everything about the other side. You know, he's negotiating with Scott Boras. He gets Scott Boras talking because somewhere in that two-hour conversation, Scott's going to give him, with a change in tone of voice, and Ned is going to hone right in on what that is. So it's usually going to be a change in their tone of voice. And you got to sit back and listen and wait for that solid gold.
Interesting, because what I'm hearing is that you have to go into negotiations almost in a meditative state to where you keep telling yourself, shut up head, because your own head is yelling at you, this and that, and what about this, and what about that? You got to shut up and listen. You got your own self. You got to tell yourself to shut up and listen to what the other person is saying so you can read what's going on. But that is a very, very hard thing to do. When I go into a negotiation, my eyes are darting around, looking around, and my thoughts are flying off, and, you know, the things are happening. And if you could see inside my head, it'd be like a, you know, welding shop with sparks and everything. How do you find that, you know? How do you find that clarity, Chris?
Well, you know, it kind of comes from just learning that the other side is going to give you what you need if you let them.
Yeah.
And if your training has been the opposite, like I've run across a lot of salespeople that have been taught, look, get to the point for the hang up, get to the point for the hang up.
Right.
That's when you got, you know, you got a welding shop going on in your head. You're scared to death that you're not going to get out what you have to say before the hang up. And that's probably the worst thing you could do, because that means you won't shut up, which means they can't hang up soon enough.
Mm, right.
So I know if I get you talking, we used to say, what's it going to take to get the bad guy out? He's going to tell you if you let him. Mm. And it's the same thing in the business deal. What's it going to take to get the deal? The other side's going to tell you if you let him. You just got to let him.
Using no to get what you want. Tell me about that.
Oh, man, I love that. I love that, because yes makes people nervous. I mean, somebody's always trying to trap us by getting us to say yes. But no, on the other hand, I mean, you'd be shocked at what people will comfortably say no to. I made a deal recently. A consultant was trying to get me to bring him on as a PR advisor for 2 months. I get a narrow project that takes a week. He's only given me a proposal for 2 months. He doesn't want to do the week. So I get him back on the phone and I say, let me get this straight. You're completely against doing this one project. You're absolutely against it. He's like, no, I'm not against that. I said, okay, well, how much? And we made the deal.
So it really boils down to amazing, amazing psychology that hostage negotiators are taught to save lives with. And when you're negotiating in business, it's your life that's on the line right there. So I suggest people check out this book, national bestseller, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Chris, I really appreciate what you do and for sharing these golden nuggets with us. And I'm sure that, you know, you have 9 in the book. And we just shared a couple awesome stuff. Thank you so much. Really enjoy that stuff. All right, you guys. Seems like we got to take another break, and then we'll be talking to Chase Jarvis, and he'll be answering some of your questions right here on Entrepreneur Radio. We'll be right back.
Is Entrepreneur Radio. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
All right, it's time for us to answer some of your questions right here on Entrepreneur Radio with my friend Chase Jarvis from The Daily Creative. Chase is also the co-founder of Creative Live, the world's leading online education platform for creatives and entrepreneurs like you and me. You can find Chase in everything he does, along with 10,000 hours of creative content featuring folks like Richard Branson, Mark Cuban, Tim Ferriss, guys like that, at creativelive.com. All right, Chase, we've got 2 quick questions for you. The first comes from Chris, and Chris wants to know if you need to be an influencer to attract high-end clients.
I think it's a great question, and I'm going to break it down for you very directly. No, you do not need to be an influencer to make a living and a life doing what you love as a creative. Now, do people need to know about you in order to hire you? Yes, that's an obvious answer. Do you have to be considered a influencer? I don't love the term. I didn't make up the term. I'm just using it because you used it and because the internet uses it. But the answer is no. And like I would say that 99% of the photographers, the architects, the entrepreneurs are not an influencer in the space. They have a great business that's made up of customers that they have pleased over and over again who continue to give them money, and they provide an amazing product or service. I see people who watch our videos and they think that that's the path. if that's not your nature, if that's not something that you enjoy doing, you don't have to do that. Like, that's just one path. And that's the thing that I think is the most beautiful part of the world that we're living in right now, is there are a million paths to any one end. Sometimes that creates anxiety because you don't have this many followers or this much engagement or this many, you're not making these videos. It's not required. If anything, take a little piece from what I'm saying, a little piece from someone else and someone else and someone else, put those together and have the thing that you are be a reflection of you, not all these online characters that you see. That actually doesn't put money in your bank account. What puts money in your bank account is A, being great at your craft and have people call you back, subscribe to your deal, whatever it is, give you money over and over and over. So, short answer, no, it doesn't require success in any of these creative fields. Does not require you to be an influencer. Go back to what I said at the top of the question, though. Do people need to know about you and your work? Yes. In order to hire you, if they don't know about you, they can't hire you. So figure out who they are, where they are, what they look at, what they pay attention to. Is it print news advertising? You need to find out where your customers spend their time and attention. I do find that there is value in creating content and distributing it on social networks because it's free and relatively easy. But there's a difference between becoming an influencer and spending so much time and energy. This has been built up over like a decade. So don't let that decade-long head start that some other people have get in the way of you realizing that you can make money tomorrow by knowing your clients are making great shit that they love and giving you money. Chris, thank you for the question. I appreciate it. I like to answer those questions because I think it helps a lot of people.
Next question is from Teresa. She's just graduated from college and she wants your advice for new grads on how to transition from being a student to getting paid.
Teresa, awesome question. I'm going to summarize it in a half a sentence. How do I make money? That's what you're asking, is how do I transition from being a student when I'm not making any money and I'm doing projects for school and for my professors and for my social followers and my friends to actually getting paid? And this is on your journey of becoming a professional creative, which is not every question on the show is about that. And my prescription for you, Teresa, is to break that down into some smaller questions. And by that I mean, who would be a logical purchaser of your work? And where do they hang out? Where do they write checks? How do they learn about photographers like you? And then you have to put yourself there. You have to go to where your customers are. So I'm going to make some assumptions and I'm going to pretend that you are a commercial photographer, that you love action sports photography, and you want to make a living. And so this is how I would think about it. Great. This is the area of action sports that I'm specifically passionate about. So who are your types of clients? Well, you have magazines. You have all the people who are in the paddling world that could potentially hire you. These are kayak companies and PFD companies and travel companies and tourism companies. And so you're going to find a list of clients and you're going to like find out who writes checks inside of those companies for that work. Who is the photo editor at the top magazines? You're going to take a bunch of pictures of that stuff, whether it was in school or more likely stuff that you have honed a great portfolio. And then you're going to put that portfolio in front of those people over and over and over. And you're going to try and visit them. You're going to try and show them your portfolio. You're going to find them at installations and exhibitions and trade shows. And you're going to become friends with these people so that they know who you are. They know that you're a badass and they'll start to buy your work. So thank you, Teresa. Don't be afraid to call in. I want to hear your questions. I want to represent the whole population. If you want your question answered, I answer these questions on the show, 802-962-4357. That spells the word help.
Thank you, Chase. And you can find more Chase Jarvis at his website, chasejarvis.com. Well, that's about it for this episode of Entrepreneur Radio. Don't forget, call in and ask Chase those questions, and we'll try and answer them again for you next week right here on Entrepreneur Radio. I'm Alan Taylor. Go out and make it a great day.
This program is copyrighted by Entrepreneur Media Incorporated.